Hey gang, are you in a band in Austin and you're looking to take your band to the professional level? Well, you can start by rehearsing at Space Rehearsal and Recording. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording, located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin with 31 spacious rooms. They have the space to help you with your creative endeavor. Just call them at 512-448-9518 or go to spaceatx.com. Tell them you heard about them on How Did I Get Here and get a free hour. All right? That's Space Rehearsal and Recording. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a great show for you guys today. If you're from Austin and you lived here like in the early 2000s, then you might know of this guy, or at least you might know of his work. Paulo Vasey is my guest today. He lives in New York City, but he used to live here in Austin, and he used to own a club called Momo's, and he took over the Steamboat Club for a while when it was on Riverside and Congress, if you guys remember, in like 2002 or 3 or something, around that time. And he also had a club on 6th Street called the Six of Clubs. Anyway, Paul was a great guy. He's had an interesting career, and he's had an interesting life. And he's an interesting guy, and he's one of my dear, dear friends. We make time for each other when we can and see each other, like, you know, get together and hang out. When he ran Momo's, we were very, very good friends. And also, man, when he ran Momo's, he was such an integral part of the scene at that point, to the point where he was a guy that like represented the music community at the city council and stuff. So he was very involved with the city and what the city was doing with music and how it was changing and how it has been changing. A lot of people have a lot of complaints about it. Anyway, his presence is sorely missed in this community. His club is sorely missed. It was a clubhouse for people to get together. You might have heard a few episodes ago when I talked to Ed Jurdy from the Heathens. We talked about Momo's and how the Heathens came together out of there, how the Coveters came together out of there, how Liars and Saints came together out of there. People banded together. Paul encouraged people getting together and playing. In this point, I remember at one point he called me some years ago when the Coveters were starting out, and he called me and he said, "Hey, I think you should join the Coveters." I wasn't ready to be in a group band then, you know? I eventually was and started Liars and Saints with Joe Hummel, Pally Powell, Casey Crowley, and Jeremy Nail, all people who played at Momo's. Momo's wasn't just a place that had music playing there, but musicians also all worked there. The guy that was taking the thing at the door, that was taking your money at the door, was probably playing on Wednesday nights. The guy behind the bar over there, he was probably playing on Thursday nights. His band might, you know what I mean? Guys that were musicians, he was like, "Oh, you know, you need some extra money. Why don't you come in and run sound?" So Paulo Vasey is a fantastic guy, very community oriented, and his club sort of took this whole community vibe. It didn't sort of take it; it actually took it. Man, we were all friends. We would go to each other's shows. We would play with each other. We would hang out after hours, talking, playing, jamming. There were jams after hours that were very, very fun. And now that club is gone. And as I've said before, I feel like it left a vacuum. Paul's, his presence leaving the scene also left a vacuum. There's people that kind of fill in different places, but no one really takes the whole thing like he did and like represents the community, like I said, at City Hall, telling Austin City Council, you know, what needed to happen with all these weird noise ordinances that have been going on since people have been moving downtown, getting worried about, you know, I'm sure that it's probably a pain in the ass sometimes, but you moved downtown. You knew what was going on down there. Anyway, my conversation with Paul is fantastic. I find out a lot of things about his early family life that I didn't know anything about. And he's always a great guy, always a great hang, always a great conversation. So my conversation with Paul is coming up in just a minute. Let me tell you what's going on with me. First things first, tonight, Tuesday, September 9th. If you are listening to this, the day that it comes out is the last day of my residency at Strange Brew. This is the last show. I've been doing it since the beginning of July, all the way to now. I have a great lineup tonight. I have Ryan Hawley, who you know I played with him for many years, still do off and on, great friends. My friend Joe Reyes from Buttercup and many other bands. He was just on the show recently. And then a very special, she doesn't do this ever, but she's doing a special solo acoustic show. Kathy Valentine from the Bluebonnets and formerly of the Go-Go's is doing a special acoustic set starting at 8 p.m. tonight at Strange Brew. Come on out and be a part of it. The very last one, if you haven't been to one, come on out. They're a lot of fun. We all play together. Sometimes everyone does their own set, but at times I get up and do songs with people, and it's fun. Good time. Come on out. Strange Brew tonight, 8 p.m., the very last show of my summer residency. All right? Let me tell you what's going on with me. I had a crazy weekend. Friday night, Skyrocket played the Zilker Relays, which is basically like at the end of a race, they have like a little party at the in a parking lot next to Zilker Park. They fence in a parking lot. They've got beer guys there. They're giving away free running shorts with, by the way, I got three pairs. We played, it rained right before we played, and then we played sort of this steamy set for people who had just run relays. And they were drinking their free beer, and they were enjoying the post-race dance party that we were giving. There was a crazy guy there that was obviously looking for love, and he had had a couple beers, and by the second set, he was getting into it. He had his shirt off. He was muscular. He had long hair and a beard. Kind of looked like a Jason Mantzoukas kind of guy, if you watch The League, or you know who Jason Mantzoukas is. Very funny actor. Anyway, he looked like that. He was very into the ladies, and he would sing to them, and he would sing the wrong words, you know, while we were playing the song, even to Jesse's girl. It was really funny. He literally didn't know any of it, but he was singing those words to those girls, and it was hilarious because there was a guy dressed as a hot dog, I guess he was racing in a hot dog suit. So he was wearing this hot dog suit, and then he was just kind of dancing there with the shirtless beard guy. It was a pretty surreal scene. Then the next, okay, so we finished that gig that night. Come home, my equipment's all wet. I have to let it all dry out in my apartment, and then get up at 5 o'clock the next morning. Pack up the stuff, be at the airport at 6, fly to Oklahoma City, jump into a shuttle with the band Skyrocket. Sorry, we're all together. Jump into a van and then go 2 hours outside of Oklahoma City to Ponca City because we're playing a fundraiser there at the Ponca City Country Club, PCCC, if you will. Place I was built like in the 50s. You know, I didn't take any pictures. I should have. It was just, I was so tired. Everyone was so tired. I think Trish took some pictures. I'll go look them up on Instagram and maybe post them on the page so you can see what I'm talking about. Anyway, so we get there. We play this party. It was fantastic. But of course, we had to get up very early the next morning and come back. We had, you know, get up at like 7. And then the funniest thing is I got up early. I went downstairs at the hotel, got a little of the free breakfast, got some cereal, got some coffee, brought it back up to my room. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take this time seriously, and I'm going to do the intro to the podcast, this intro. And I'm going to do it in Ponca City, Oklahoma, in my hotel room. It'll sound different, and it'll be good for you guys, the listeners. Hey, this is what I do. I'm out on tour. So I sit down, and I do it, and I worked it out. It was great, very heartfelt. But through the whole thing, I kept on referring to my residency at Strange Brew as my residency at Momo's. Because I knew I was doing the intro to Paulo Vasey, and I'd been talking about Momo's passionately because I loved that place so much, and so many of us did, and we miss Paul so much as being part of the scene, but I'm so glad that Paul's still my friend, still a part of my life. He is the boyfriend of Susanna Schaffel, guest number one on this show, and you know I care about her a lot. They are two of my dear, dear, dear friends, and I think about them a lot. I miss them because they're gone. Paul's presence is missed here. Like crazy. I can't say it enough. And hopefully he'll come back a lot and we'll get to see him. And we'll get to see what his restaurants are like in New York. All right, so sit down. Enjoy my conversation with my dear friend, the very intelligent, the very witty, and the very caring, huge music fan, Paul Ovesi. Let's get down.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make a film about a man that's sad and lonely.
Yeah. Do you miss Austin? And just sort of like, I mean, you were such a... You were there at city council meetings. You were... That was the thing with that Heathens conversation was that I remember once you called me and you were like, hey, you should be in the Coveters.
Did I? Yeah. That's all right. That sounds right.
I told Susanna you should be in the Coveters.
Yeah.
So you were always kind of plotting and scheming more than just like booking your club and doing that thing. You were always involved in more.
Yeah, I mean, it's how can you not? How can you be?
Of course.
How can you participate in something like the music community in Austin and not get a sense of the larger organism? And particularly as a, you know, being a venue owner was one thing and kind of secluded for a little bit. And then we got into a couple of other projects, and then getting into management of bands, and then and then participating on the civic level.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to see the organism from different lenses.
Yeah.
And so the you know, your question is, do you miss Austin? It's of course. I mean, that was I feel very attached. I've lived in Austin my whole life. The exception of a few years going away to school, but there's no way. You can't live 40 years somewhere and not ever it be a major part of who you are. And on top of this, it's not so, you know, it's not so melancholy because I'm here half the time too. So
yeah, you've got kids, you've got roots here.
Yeah,
Susanna comes back here a lot for work.
Yeah,
she seems to be doing a lot more stuff here than she was for the last few years.
Yeah, she goes. She has some luxuries now, I think, in her career because she has put in some time. She put in some time in New York. She put in some time
nationally
in Europe. Yeah,
yeah,
Europe. And so now she has she can, you know, retreat for periods of time to any of those places and just plug right in.
Yeah. What made you go to New York? I mean, what was that? What was the catalyst?
You know, there's not a like a single thing. It was kind of it was a chain of events. Not the least of which was everything we just talked about. I was so immersed in a particular thing. It really had a desire to expand, to get out of my comfort zone and do something that was stimulating. And you know, that like
seems like that's been the theme of your of your life.
Maybe,
I mean, right? Yeah. You started out in law.
Yeah.
He went into owning a club, which is totally not comfortable compared to being a lawyer. Yeah,
no, not even that. Yeah.
So you wanted to get out of your comfort zone and
and probably in hindsight, I probably would have worn a lot more hats if it wasn't for the addiction of Momos for probably 5 years for me. That was all I did. It was a huge part of my identity. Just living and eating and breathing the place. Because it was so magical, there were so many awesome relationships, and you got to see, it was just, everything happened so fast that I lost track of my, you know, desire to like expand and try other things and be entrepreneurial and creative and see the world and get out of town. It just kind of didn't happen because... you got caught up in the, as you kind of described, in your podcast with the Heathens, where you very accurately kind of depicted all the little micro scenes in Austin over the last three, probably decades.
Yeah.
That's very special to be a part of and probably a dying thing.
Yeah.
Right. Because this, the trajectory for this town is we're headed to a new place. And I think that place still has those micro scenes, but not like it was before.
No, that's definitely something that's changed. I mean, and I guess that's indicative of the times it happens. Like there's so much for people to do just on their phone.
Yeah.
That they don't, you know what I mean? It's difficult to get people to go and do stuff. Like it was a big,
how did we used to, I was trying to remember, did we, pre-cell phones, did you have to stay by your landline until you found out what was going on?
You had to check your messages.
Because once you left, pre-digital answering machine, like old, you know.
Yeah, I had one of those guys.
Yeah. But it's amazing to me that I had any social life.
Well, the weirdest thing to me is like touring, because like I don't even go like to Kimmy Rhodes' house to record without my GPS. I've been out there like 7 times. I have no idea how to get there.
You can't get there without your GPS? Yeah, I'm pretty
No,
bad
but
too.
Like I used to tour like my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, without.
How did you do it? I don't understand.
I don't know. How did you let people know you were going to be late? What happened when you broke down? Someone helped you out. It's so weird. Okay, so let's go back. So you're from here. You're born here. Where your parents from?
Yeah,
here?
Yeah. So my parents emigrated from Iran.
Right.
You're
first generation.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm definitely first generation. They came here specifically to go to UT. They were young, and you know, back then in Iran, that's what a young person did. You went to the Western Hemisphere to get an education, and maybe you would come back, maybe you wouldn't. So they just picked Austin kind of like sight unseen.
Wow.
And came with a group. There was a group of like young Iranian couples. We all lived in married student housing, you know, on Colorado Apartments, still there on Lake Austin Boulevard.
Yeah.
No car, very little English, you know, tiny little apartment. But pretty awesome. I mean, that was
wow.
Barton Springs and Deep Eddy Pool, like regular parts of that, my like early childhood memory. I was fat. had hippie Persian parents.
They were hippies?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. So that's
like,
that's
what kind
the
of
whole...
hippies did they used to take you to like the
they, well the
what's the
big,
why am I drawing a blank on
the
it?
Big thing that I remember was the late night jams. So it would be like, I don't know, 10, if you can imagine 10 like young college Iranian men and women, put the kids to bed. But we, you know, we're obviously like sneaking up and watching this amazing, ridiculous, kind of embarrassing, like dancing, pots and pans, singing, like classic Iranian
wow.
style. And you know, just drunk and
yeah.
probably high, and you know, it's the '70s in Austin, Texas.
That's such a weird, it's hard for me to imagine. And it was just, you were like, I wasn't here, but we came here a lot when I was a kid, and we used to go to Barton Springs and we used to go to the shows. And I remember watching jazz on cable access, like when my mom went out somewhere I couldn't go watching. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so you grew up here. What did your parents end up doing?
So they both, you know, mom raised us. She was an artist, though. She was she had her degree in graphic design. By the way, both of them, like, it's kind of beyond me that they came here speaking hardly any English and just could function and get degrees.
Without cell phones.
Yeah. Right. And then dad became a... economics and got his PhD and was a professor.
Wow.
So did that whole route. And so I, you know, we got out of the married student housing when he got his first kind of teaching gig, his assistant professor gig.
Yeah.
And we ended up buying a house. So I grew up from grade
brother,
school
right?
on. Yeah. A little. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
You know him. Don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. We can talk about him.
Yeah.
And we moved to what is now called Northwest Hills in Austin. I don't know if you know the neighborhood, but that was like brand new, big ass houses with pools. We had a pool.
Oh.
We moved into a house with a pool. So that was. I grew up in kind of suburban North, you know,
Austin.
Upper middle class. Yeah. In the 80s. It was, you know.
Yeah.
I want to say, you know, Dazed and Confused was set about a decade before.
Right.
But that was the setting. The,
yeah.
You know, going to Top Notch for lunch.
Yeah.
You know, I got obsessed with football. I had no, it was forbidden for us to play sports because it was a distraction from academics.
Okay.
But I forged dad's signature because I was so badly wanted to play football.
What position were you?
Man,
a small guy.
I was small. I was weak, slow, and didn't even know the like. I didn't know how to put on the gear, but it was. I was definitely like my freshman year. I was the like kind of joke of the team, kind of the like, you know, what's this Persian skinny, slow, like no ability. But fuck, it was like, you know, I was obsessed and figured it out. So it took me a year. My sophomore year, I grew into my body.
Right.
I obsessed with the game, and everybody kind of took note. Like, all right, I might have been like a little Rudy had on their hands, and then blew my knee out bad, and that whole dream was over.
But you wanted to be, were you on that, like, this is kind of what I want to do, I'd like to go to college on this, I'd like to get into a pro team?
No, come on, man, you're, 15 years old.
I was pretty serious. I mean, I had the same, I might have even been more intense about what I wanted to do when I was 15.
Really?
Than I am now, yeah.
What, did you want to be a performer?
Now, yeah.
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 See, I didn't have, I talk to Suze about it all the time, because she's the same way from an early age, like, this is what I want
to
do.
Yeah. It's weird when I talk to people, like my brother and sister, like in their mid 20s, were like, I don't know what I want to do with my life. I'm like, fuck, I've known since I was 13. Yeah, like, yeah. That must be so weird to not know what you want to do growing up.
Yeah. I think it's a pain in the ass, not knowing, but it's also kind of liberating.
And sure. It seems liberating. Yeah. So what did you outside of football, was music an interest then?
Man, I loved the, like, I don't know what to call this era of country music, but when I was definitely really into country music from an early age. And we're talking about the post, like right after the Hank and Waylon and Willie kind of scene, but before Garth Brooks,
right?
That kind of that era, 80s. Right in there, yeah. 80s, yeah. 80s country,
yeah.
And growing up in Austin, I mean, you it was everywhere,
yeah.
And we would go to Aquafest. I volunteered at Aquafest early, and we got to see all the shows. And then the rodeo had cool country. And then, in high school, I just felt like I was probably like your typical Austin, 80s Austin music consumer. I mean, a little bit of everything, new wave was coming on.
Right.
And
that was big here.
And then when they did busing. So, I got out of my comfort zone in Northwest Austin and went to junior high on the East Side at Martin Junior High.
Oh, wow.
And that's where, I got turned on to like that early hip hop scene. So you have that whole, all those 80s were fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good time to be.
Did you get shit like racially over there?
Or
did you pretend to be Mexican?
Well, they didn't know what I was. You know, right. I wasn't Mexican, but I wasn't. Yeah. Clearly, it wasn't white too.
Right,
so
right.
Like, I kind of slid by, and a lot of my friends, man, I could think of two or three friends that just got jumped, and we didn't even know that existed.
Yeah,
like our guards are down, and you're. After school, if you're participating in sports or any kind of extracurricular shit, and you walk out to the bus or whatever, you're like, you got to watch. That was a rough neighborhood.
That's intense, man.
I didn't even know that existed. I mean, that was so foreign to me. So it was kind of like 2 years of culturally eye-opening for me. And
did you go to high school back in your neighborhood?
Yeah. Okay. They did away with busing, think. After 2 years, and then I went back to Anderson. That's where I started and completed high school.
And then, did you go to UT?
Yeah,
went to UT. You just
yeah, I just did
the Austin around. You're like Austin guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you went to UT law school?
No, I went to law school in Dallas. I went to SMU.
Oh, wow.
For law school, and then I came back. I did law school's 3 years. Immediately came back, miraculously graduated, and miraculously passed the bar exam.
What kind of lawyer did you go? Did you start practicing then?
Yeah, yeah. I got a gig for. So in the summer, I came down and clerked in Austin, and I just law school was when I realized how much smarter everybody was than I was.
Yeah.
I just kind of abandoned hope because these were really bright, way better educated, extremely well read, like just intellectually curious on a level that. Pissed me off that I wasn't.
Right.
I was just kind of like, I felt like I was going to be desperate for a job. So as soon as I got a clerkship in Austin, and the job market sucked and everybody was, how did you get that's fucking hard to do. Get a clerkship in Austin.
Yeah.
I didn't have good grades.
Yeah.
So I just put, I went all in with that firm,
yeah,
and charmed the, you know, just worked my ass off. And this is like, I have to get this gig or I'm fucked.
Yeah.
And they did. They said, you know, come down and, take the bar and pass it and practice law. And I did. It was a general civil, with a lot of litigation, but it was just general practice law firm. With
what
maybe
were you
like
doing,
a
like
dozen.
Divorces? What were you?
No, I was doing, did some real estate stuff. And then I probably did a shitload of, med mal defense.
Okay.
So, cause we had a client who was in, hospitals, county hospitals, which get sued all the time. And that whole thing for me was just, and I should have known better. I got so romantically caught up in the notion of being a lawyer, and so young and, you know,
like being able to do something,
you know, I read two John Grisham books and I was like, yeah, I'm going to, that's, you know, but sit, you know, I feel like I'm offending a lot of people who I respect, but sitting at a desk inside for most of your day is the worst thing you can do. There's nothing more toxic and not what we were meant to do. Just physically, that's just not.
That's a tough one.
You know, there's a lot. I just described a whole swath of people. That's and. For
people
me, that toxicity.
Listening to this.
Yeah, it's
not for everyone. Some people. That's.
I don't.
You know.
I don't think it's for anyone. I think some people have a good ability to tolerate it.
Right.
Right now, but it, ultimately, that's nobody should be doing that. That's a toxic environment. It's not. It's. You're not operating at your full potential if you're sitting down in artificial lighting for hours on end and not moving your body and engaging in interesting ways. So. Anyway, I wasn't that insightful about it all. I just hated going to work. I truly hated going to work. There was nothing stimulating about it. The people were okay, but even then, I mean, I had some just minor like discovery hearings. Discoveries like pretrial stuff, and you know this.
Yeah.
Where lawyers would almost fight. Yeah. I had to separate grown men.
Yeah.
And just. I was turned off by the whole thing.
Yeah.
There's just, it's just gross and it wasn't for me. And, I wasn't very smart about, my repulsion to the thing. And
then
I just,
open about it.
I had a wife and two babies.
Yeah.
And so the smart thing to do is, man, keep your job, brother. You gotta support your family. And instead I just gave my 2 week notice and then went home and told my wife, like, hey, I'm going to do something entrepreneurial. Don't worry about it. I got you. I got us covered. And of course, that was the beginning of a little dark period.
What did you do?
So I quit. I stumbled around trying to do. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I know I wanted to be an entrepreneur.
You wanted to be your own person.
Yeah,
there's people that have that drive.
And,
you know,
and part of me thought I might get into, you know. Shit, I'm a lawyer. Maybe I'll do entertainment law. And I didn't even know what that meant, but somehow that itch got me down a path where the bar on 6th and Rio Grande that I found out was for sale. It dawned on me like that could be so. So Momo's actually had existed. A couple of guys opened it up. They named it and were open for.
Who owned it at first?
John and Chris. I don't know if you know those two guys.
Who booked it back then? Do you
yeah,
remember
so there was this girl, Rebecca.
Oh, yeah. Red-haired Rebecca.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so when I, you know, it was interesting because it was kind of like a jazzy, loungy.
Yeah, well, it was top of the mark. Right?
Yeah, it was kind of had that vibe going on. And this girl, Rebecca, who when I took over, she said, you know, I'd love to work for you. You know, and I'm in my mind, I'm like, I have no, I don't know anything about the bar business, let alone the music business. So absolutely, you got a job.
And but wait a minute. Sorry, let's go back. Were you going out to see music when you were a lawyer and were you forging relationships? You have amazing relationships with musicians.
I think
like you're friends with a lot of musicians.
Yeah. But all of that is really
From Momo's.
From Momo's, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I didn't know if like you just kind of like...
No, man. I mean, I definitely was, you know, I saw a lot of cool shows with a fake ID growing up in Austin.
Yeah.
And then when I got into school, I totally unplugged socially. So
okay.
I missed the whole like, I missed the whole Steamboat
yeah.
era.
That would have been during your college
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right, let's go up. So you find out that this place is
yep,
they're selling the
yep,
club.
Yeah. And, I'd said, all right, let's do it. I'm going to be a music venue. And, so this girl, Rebecca, who was the booking agent for the club, she was young, but she was so plugged in.
Yeah.
And I just followed her around. So then, you know what the scene was? You know what the micro scene that was really hot?
Zendo Sheen.
It was,
right?
Lucy's.
Yeah. It was Zendo Sheen. And yeah, you know what? Can I tell you this one thing? Interrupt you?
You didn't bring it up.
I never went in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never
it was
went
quick.
Into Lucy's.
Yeah. You missed that whole era. Huh?
I missed that whole. I'd gotten signed. I went to LA and was making a record and kind of like a little bit unplugged, just kind of like kept up with my friends.
Yeah.
When I came back, that was a new scene with bands I'd never heard of. Canvas,
yeah.
Endoshine.
Yeah, yeah.
Bands that I'd end up producing and playing with
yeah.
and stuff. But yeah.
It was,
so.
And it was, what was remarkable about that scene was it was diverse too, because you had the like, it was on 6th Street, but you remember the like the Reckless Kelly and the like George DeVore scene, like all that.
They were playing there?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they were totally playing. And all those guys, you know, like pretty different scenes musically and like socially.
Yeah, yeah.
But all kind of convened at, I was totally jealous. I mean, it was like, this is, and then I shit you not, months had not passed since I took over Momo's and Lucy's closed. And I just inherited that scene. Because there wasn't really a place to play downtown.
Rebecca was plugged into it.
She was plugged into it, and she'd been pitching the place to the guys for months.
Yeah,
And they would come over. Like we were starting to kind of build something, but that was the catalyst. That was the tipping point for Momo's. Was from not just a little loungy club with a stage to a legitimate live music venue. Was
what year was that? 2001, 2002?
Probably, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, 2002, and then that dovetailed into. So,
Steamboat, right?
I somehow got tangled up in a East 6th Street club for like a year. Do you remember Six of Clubs? You remember Six of Clubs?
Yeah.
Which I forget. Sometimes I
what
talk
was,
about.
What was that?
It was.
It was just a bar.
No, it was. It was a total like.
Six of Clubs. Yeah, did we play there.
I mean, we had you did. You did.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a tiny little moment, but it was like the, what was his name? The guy that I kind of took it over from, Josh.
The Metro guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was kind of like that, Metro. Yeah. That's what it was before.
Right.
And that had like died.
Yeah.
But the space was still there and I saw an opportunity to go in and make it sound better and we would do some road shows, but you know, like. In hindsight, that was East 6th Street was kind of in its last throes.
Yeah.
And I say East 6th Street, meaning still west of I-35.
Right, right.
Because that East 6th Street didn't exist back then.
Right.
But I don't know where
we were in, you took over Six of Clubs, but you had Momo's, and then you went into a foray into Steamboat.
Yes.
So what you had Momo's for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, I'm going to start doing other clubs.
Well, it just totally... It wasn't planned that way. It was just total kind of circumstantial.
Right.
So Steamboat, you probably know the story better than I, but I wasn't plugged in. And I mean, but the stories I would like, it almost like drove me insane. Cause I couldn't go anywhere without hearing the like reminiscing of Steamboat.
Yeah.
And, and I was like, I don't know anything about that scene, but everybody's so passionate about it.
It had a big, you didn't notice it when you were in the thing, but in hindsight, you look back, you're like, it really casts a large shadow.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so much great music came. And you know what? Like, the ingredients are pretty simple. It's a small group of people who really give a fuck. And nobody's really obsessed with like trying to churn a profit. It's more about the music. And that's not a sustainable business model,
no,
but it exists in spurts. And Steamboat had that. And that's like, that's a great thing for an artist to have that.
For a while, there was a place where it crossed, because I would say in the early and mid 90s, it did do very well.
You know? So that was I'm running Momo's, and I'm hearing about the Steamboat's coming back. I'm hearing
right.
And then it did. It reopened at that spot at Riverside and Congress, and it ran for about, I don't know, maybe 9 months, and then I got a call from Alex Ruiz from Del Castillo one night, like late, well after 2 a.m. probably. And he had like this serious tone to him and said, hey, I want to talk to you about something. And let me just cut to the chase. Danny is shutting down Steamboat. And he just did the courtesy calls to everybody, all the musicians that were playing in the next few weeks. And we all kind of met and everybody's crying. And we just kind of brainstorming, would you at all be interested in taking it over? Because we would not like this is not out in the press yet. You know, it's let's keep this thing going. But he's broke and he's sick and he can't do it anymore. I think on the phone I said, I'll be right there. But yes, like not like the correct response would have been, well, let's take a look at the numbers. Let's see what the situation is. And instead, I was just like, abso-fucking-lutely. I've been hearing about this thing forever. I would love to try to keep it going. And that was horribly timed, because that was on the, so I had just finished, I guess the early legal part of divorce proceedings.
Okay.
You know, Momo's was, needed a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had that East 6th Street kind of distraction for about a year. So for me, that was kind of tough for me to reminisce about that, 'cause it was really like, cloudy.
Yeah.
Time
you were trying to get out of.
Yeah. Really like, I feel like I aged a decade in like 2 years, you know? And like, so it's a horrible, this is like the burnout, that you hear about. Like I had a firsthand kind of dance with that situation. And that's when Steamboat happened. So that was, you know, so Steamboat, we threw our heart into it.
Mm-hmm.
We had some great shows. But
that was so huge. It was just
a horrible
and such a weird setup.
Yeah.
With the bars outside of the thing, and it just
you could not make a living in that space just doing that. So
that was rough.
It was really, really rough. And God, close. I mean, it's surreal for me to specifically reminisce about that, because I'm just remembering the people and like sleeping. I slept at the club. I slept at the club all the time. I was virtually homeless, you know, kicked out of the house and going through a divorce and two babies. And I gained like 15 pounds. That, you remember, what was that? I think it's still there, that Jack in the Box right down the road from Steamboat.
Oh, yeah.
That was my kitchen.
Yeah.
Sleeping at the club. It was great and torturous memories, from that place.
Yeah.
And it was only a year. It was remarkable how much, but also like, you know, we had Elliot Smith's last show and,
Gowdy's last show.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was a farewell show with Canvas.
Oh, awesome.
You were there, because I remember.
I'm sure I was probably there.
I remember talking to you for the first time, really at length, that night.
That's the first time we met?
No. We'd met, but we were talking.
Do you know what my first memory is of you? It's very vivid. In a good way.
Okay, good.
It was, you guys were doing the India Records Showcase.
Oh, yeah.
At Momo's, like on a Tuesday night. And I'd missed like the first couple, and I was downstairs talking to somebody, and I heard your voice sing. You just kind of doing a solo thing, and I was like, I think I told my little brother, like, we have to go check this chick out.
Awesome. That's pretty cool. All my favorite singers are girls. Yeah. I think that that's where I got my singing from, girls.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Steamboat closes.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Steamboat closed, and then...
When did it close? Like, what was the time
frame? I think it was 2003 or 2004.
Whoa, it went on for a while then after I did my last show there.
I think I may have the years wrong. I remember
Were you there when Bearwald was doing those happy hours?
Yes. Yeah.
Like that's the first time I ever went there like that. And I was like, holy shit, this is like an empty theater.
And I know. There was no way to minimize the, like, I mean, you could have 100 people in there and it still felt weird.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's funny is I played there in the 90s. When it was a dance club that had music on like a night or something. I played there with Joe Rockhead.
What was that club called?
I can't even remember.
But was it called Escape?
Maybe. I don't know. Now that building just sits there empty.
Yeah.
Used to be a last place it was a Dick Dancer place.
Yeah, yeah, no, I worked there. Yeah. It's good money.
So you get through your divorce and you obviously those are dark times and mm-hmm. you get out of the Steamboat thing. Mm-hmm. How did you turn it around? Because then when we actually started becoming friends, you were a positive, fit guy.
Yeah. So not the
no Jack in the Box.
No. I think the good part of rock bottom, is it's an opportunity. I don't know what the turning point was, but, it was very likely my two kids, at some point once your ego is completely deflated and you feel like you've let everybody and yourself down, at least try to provide for your kids.
Yeah.
So that was for a while that just gave me some clarity, but also, man, I found, exercise became a huge part of my life in high school when I tried to become morph my body into a football player. It was like skinny, slow, unathletic Persian nerd. Mm-hmm. I just found I would work and work out and, I just got back and got motivated. And keep in mind, I'm around a pretty burgeoning little scene. Like I would get goosebumps at shows at Momo's frequently. And I can't remember the last time I got goosebumps at a show. It hasn't been recently, but, and look around and it's, you know, it became everybody that worked there, the whole crew. And it was very much a family oriented environment. We was all music people, either musicians or people who worked in music, everybody. Yeah. So everybody kind of felt attached to making sure this organism survived because everybody was a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't feel like a job for, I think, a lot of people because, and it was great having musicians as part of the crew because you stayed in the, like you were in, you heard everything first.
Yeah.
And everybody had home, like, all right, hey, two musicians who would never even dream about collaborating just happened to be drinking, hanging out late night. Like, you know what? Wouldn't it be interesting if we did that conversation would actually end up on stage?
Yeah.
And we would do. Did you ever late night jam?
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite things to see. Yeah. The like lock the doors.
Yeah. Great times.
Yeah.
That's where those bands were coming out of. So the scene was burgeoning then. Would you say, what was that, like 2005, 2006? Yeah,
yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that was around the same time I feel like I got kind of duped into the civic arena a little bit. So I was...
How would you say you got duped into somebody?
That's a horrible word. It's a horrible word. But the...
It's unbecoming of a lawyer.
It's getting into like dabbling into light band management for a couple of years.
Yeah, you worked with Band of Heathens.
Uh huh.
Susanna.
No, I never worked with. No,
you didn't.
No. Not in that department.
No.
So it was the Heathens. It was the Band of Heathens, yeah. and then Dan Dyer.
Right.
And so that was really my two management kind of explorations, and I loved it, man. It was I loved working intimately with all those musicians a lot. And that was the first of like getting out of my skin a little bit and not just being at a club and, you know, participating in creation on a different level. That was really addictive for me to get into. And so, and so after doing that for a couple of years, and there's a community, there's the Austin music kind of business community that I never really, participated in, but I started kind of hanging around some of these guys.
Musician guys. And then you started hanging out with,
you know, other managers and, you know, just, you know, the small scene that does exist here is a pretty tight knit scene. There's a lot of good people.
Who was in that scene that we would know, people listening?
What do you mean in
the business scene that you're talking about?
You know, I just, I feel like, you know, at first I start, the first person to reach out to me, as like a peer with a warm heart and a complimentary tone was Clifford Antone.
Always pretty much in a lot of things, he's like that.
And really like, you know, like he sought me out. He came to the club and sought me out and said, you know, something like, I just appreciate what you're doing. We should have coffee, or, you know, we should get together. And I did, we did. And I would go, and he was just, I always like, kind of wise and visionary, but not in a like larger than life way, like real subtle kind of warm. For me, before that I'd felt totally excluded from the, like, cause most people in the Austin music community have been doing it for so long. And like, who's this kid, lawyer kid that thinks he's going to run a club. So I was pretty detached. And I think he kind of brought me into the world. And then of course, dabbling with the other clubs, like it was inevitable, that I would just kind of be immersed in this music community. So, but it was the phone call I got, from City Hall was, I think it was Nikki Rowling. Remember her from Austin Music Foundation?
Totally.
And she, that's, talk about another person who, like, there's just a handful of people in Austin that have contributed selflessly.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
In Austin. And she's definitely in that, on that list. But she called and said, look, I'm leaving the Austin Music Commission. And so are a lot of other people. And, I don't know if she's like, she felt me out. She said, are you kind of in tune with the, like the grumblings of, you know, Austin's growing and the music community is kind of going through some issues. And of course I, you know, I'm intimately aware with all that stuff, whether it affected venues or musicians or whatever. And she said, well, you should consider throwing your name in the hat because, there's going to be some vacancies on the music commission. And that made so much sense to me.
Yeah.
To be able to like go and represent the music community to City Hall. That was like that felt like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And then like within a year of that happening, Will Wynn, asked me at Momo's, he said, I'm doing like, it started to get annoying, the complaints that were going, like it was, Austin had really kind of morphed into, remember all the like sound issues and everything, all the shit kind of was hitting the fan. Yeah.
So, I didn't know if you were talking about that weird minimum wage thing that people were trying to get going that I thought was retarded.
No, I'm talking about the all like just, you know, the Austin is the live music capital of the world, seemed to be in danger. And
there was a lot, you know, too many people moving in downtown complaining about the music and the sound and too loud.
So then they did this task force. I don't know if you remember the live music task force. And we went all in. We were like, all right, the city wants to know what our bitch is, what our gripe is. All right, we're gonna go compile that information. We're gonna present it to you. And and we did. And it was a pain in the ass because there were two arch enemies in this discussion. There was like these neighborhood people, and then there was these music people, and it turned out they weren't really arch enemies. They just kind of like, it's kind of the Austin thing. I mean, your gripe, you get away from everybody feels like they have to be griping about something.
Yeah.
And so everybody gets into their gripe and forgetting that this is such a workable solution. These, like, everybody can coexist. Music does not have to be antithetical to a good community.
Right.
So, and you know, So I got really caught up in that whole, like, you know, politics on that level, on a local, micro local level is.
You totally were. I remember at one point you told me to go and talk to. It was somebody that asked me to talk to you. That was weird because then for a minute I felt like, oh wow, I'm in this political situation.
That's what I was trying to do, though.
Somebody had gotten me to see if I would get you to talk to them, and you said, oh no, I'm not going to back that guy for city council. You know Laura Morrison, right?
Yeah, well.
No, that was you. And you said that to me, and then I said, no, I don't know Laura Morrison. And you said, well then, hang on. And I went to lunch with her because of you.
Okay, all
you
right.
set up
all
a
right.
lunch
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that sounds right.
For me in this.
Well, life. that was my job. That was like I wanted to literally connect the music community to city leadership.
The city, yeah.
And how we did that was, and they all wanted to. I mean, it was a no-brainer for them. Like, to embrace the music community was a no-brainer.
Of course.
There was just no mechanism. There wasn't a bridge between those two worlds. They're really kind of separate.
Mutually.
Mike Martinez was a huge kind of, very instrumental in really being aggressive and pushing the two communities to come together. And so that became, so the Live Music Task Force for me became, the follow-up to that was to create a nonprofit. And then so that whole following year, we worked to create Austin Music People. So that was like the natural. So the Music Commission and the Live Music Task Force go to the city and say, look, these are our problems. And these are our suggestions for how to fix them. And some of those are institutional. You have to create an office. You have to commit some resources to this. And then the other part was, cultural. And so what we were trying to do is we were going to create an entity that represented the entire music community, that actually had some like attempt at power, at wielding influence,
right.
And
lobby.
Yeah,
music
yeah.
people.
And that took a year to do because, you know, you had like the music community was so fragmented.
Yeah.
Like I remember going and sitting down with probably hundreds of people from club owners to musicians and like trying to explain what it is we're trying to do. And everybody was just had already given up. Like it really took a lot to convince people to participate. And even now, like, It's I feel like it's come a long way to the positive, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Do you keep up with any of that stuff?
Yeah, I totally do. I totally do. Yeah, I get the newsletters and I have the phone calls with everybody from time to time.
Yeah.
It's
Were you asking if I feel like it's
what I was going to ask you is do you feel like you're participating still on that level? Do you?
No. I feel like
that's all right.
No. I got this.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's all right. People on this level. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I was never that gung-ho about that, although I do believe I believe strongly that people should be more involved in their civic sort of politics rather than national, even though it's not as glamorous because you can actually get things done. And then that stuff kind of moves up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, don't you agree?
Yeah, no, and it feels better too. I mean, because
you can get a light put on the street in front of your house, but you can't get the president to...
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, but the like, you know, like right now, there's an intelligent... Not that I'm well versed in this discussion, but like there's a conundrum right now with the city. Like, how do we fix transportation? How do we prioritize transportation fix? Because there's not a budget to fix everything at once.
Right,
you have to do it kind of piecemeal.
Yeah,
and the problem with people who don't participate is, in my opinion, what you see happening in California, where everybody wants all the services but nobody wants to pay for them.
Right,
and I feel like that to me is detachment. Because
right.
if you feel the pain, if you're going down to those meetings and listening to all the people frothing at the mouth about issues, like you start to kind of get a sense of priority. Like we have to fix these things. We have to be smart about it. And it all costs money.
Yeah,
it's tough. It's tough for people to want to give the public money
right.
when nobody trusts government. And I think the way to whittle away at that is to participate on the local level, because you actually see those resources and what they're used for. And you get to participate in the discussion of where they go and, you know, what needs to be prioritized. Do we need sidewalks before we need bike lanes, or do we need,
right?
You know,
yeah.
Shit. I mean, what have we fixed the Uber thing down here yet? Is that still
Uber's still going?
Is it going?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you like it?
That's great.
Yeah,
that's gonna change so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny to watch in Austin, because I feel like there's a cab driver community that's against it, but
sure.
You know, they actually, I think they stand to do better.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, to me, there's just more choices, and that gives you a thing. Like, you know, I'm a member of Car to Go, and I started avoiding drinking and driving by taking a Car to Go, which you only use for like 15 minutes to get downtown and take a cab home. It's like $7.
Do you ride your bike?
Nope. I got hit by a car when I was in. This is true. Got hit by a car when I was in ninth grade. And I had a bike a little bit in my 20s. I used to bike with my wife, but I would get real clammy, and like my grip would be hard to undo because I would be holding it so unnaturally tight.
You're still carrying that?
Yeah. Still freaked out. Anyway, so then Momo's closed down, and you moved to New York. When a place like Momo's closed down, I talked about it, that in the scene, it definitely left a vacuum. Because it, you know, there were people that kind of like, that was their place.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of how I do a thing. I kind of find a good place where you get along with someone that runs a place, you like playing there, it works out, you go do it. And so when that left, can you see where the people dispersed to? Almost like, you know, where did the rats go when the boat sank?
I mean, the timing was a shame too, because there was like this new scene happening. Like all this kind of younger group was coming into its own.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to have, you know, had a home to see some of that grow, but it's going to find a home. And it did. You're right. Sure. I mean, you know,
Hotel Strange, Vegas picked up some stuff.
Vegas, Strange Brew, and God, there's a whole lot of like little. There's a lot of venues I haven't been to yet.
Have you been to Gypsy Lounge?
I have not.
I've been there a couple times. Yeah. Good place.
I met you one night at the White Horse.
Yep.
That's a fun. It's like a hipster honky tonk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's brilliant.
The White Horse weirds me out sometimes. It's people. I mean, that place is like a sex palace.
Is it really?
My God, it's like. I've been there before where I've been like, man, this is like a little too crazy. Like everyone's emitting the scent. There's pheromones in the air, so thick. You can cut it with a knife. Yeah, it gets pretty intense.
Does Joe Hummel live there?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
yeah.
That's the guy who brought me to New York for the first time.
Really?
Yeah. You know, he was. He's a big part of Momo's too. He worked the door, and he was a drummer in a lot of bands. And like, anyway, that was a really fun trip, because it was very spontaneous. It was one of those like late night into the morning, like, you know what we should do? Let's go to New York. And Joe followed up. He's like, okay, here's, you know, get your ticket. This is the date. And I did. And, we had a blast. And ended up going to Farm Aid
on
Randall's Island and hanging out with Willie's camp. And then everybody went to, what's that kind of honky-tonk Lower East Side? Anyway, I can't remember the name of the bar. Had a like just the time of our life.
That's awesome.
And that is when, so circling back to your question, that was like the first seed that I might like to do. I'd love to do a Momo's in New York. That'd be fun. That'd be, you know, and.
Is that what you were going for with Zierzameen? That was a great place, by the way.
Yeah.
I loved my gig there.
That was a fun little joint. That was kind of a side. I felt like that was an opportunity because of the situation and it kind of bit us in the ass because it was in the basement. And then after Sandy, like it just, I mean, there was.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, it was. We got like raw sewage that filled up the place, and like we had to walk. It was really vile. But for, you know,
That happened just a month or so, 2 months after I played there.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But wouldn't it a little sexy little
fucking great place, thing? Man. And I played on the night, the drummer from the Saturday Night Live band and the guy from Brazilian Girls played as well. They have a side band that played that night.
Yeah. Cool. We had a lot of fun late night jams in there where we were closed, but there's some jazz clubs in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And some of those cats would just walk by and hear us jamming and come in. And we'd let them in, and everybody would just, anyway, the words late night in New York mean something different than in Austin, because it's like an extra 3 hours.
Yeah.
Because the party doesn't stop till 4 in a lot of places in New York. So if you're going after hours after 4. So
you're like talking you're there till 7, 8 in the morning.
I know that I've seen you with the sun coming up at MoMo's. There's no doubt, right?
Yep, I can't do it anymore, man.
Yeah, me neither.
I really can't. I really can't. And you know what's funny is there's guys like Joseph King who we're friends with that, like, I leave whatever he's doing at like 11 because I can't.
Is he still going?
I just can't hang in there anymore. Just get tired. Yep. I wake up early and I have a lot of stuff to do. It's interesting because it kind of, once I started this, and I had to do this with somebody totally hungover and on 3 hours of sleep.
It's no more.
I was like, this is not cool.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not having fun. I don't want to listen to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Happens. Get old. Yeah. So, then you did some stuff with Hill Country.
Yes.
Guys are nice.
Yeah. Oh, they love you, too, up there.
Love those guys.
Yeah. So the whole New York thing was, the master plan for me was to get into restaurants. That was the... not that I didn't want to do music anymore, but I did want a new challenge, and I worked in restaurants my entire life too. Definitely, like, all my first jobs were in restaurants, and I, you know, even was a cook. But I went to New York kind of specifically, like, I want to learn how to do like a high volume restaurant concept. We had a concept in mind, and I still needed to kind of flesh it out. And so I was actually looking for, I was helping Susanna look for some, like, you know, music teaching gigs to kind of help us get acclimated to New York before we figured it out. And I stumbled onto, Hill Country was looking for somebody to help them with their music program. And I called them up, and they were like, we know who you are. We've been to MoMo's. What are you doing up here?
Yeah.
And so I told them, I said, I want to do restaurants. And they said, well, we struck an instant deal. Like, you come help us with developing our music program. Like, we want to have a legitimate multiple restaurant, real stage, good sound, good booking program, good publicity. Like, we want this to be part of our culture.
Yeah.
Can you help us with that? And in turn, you know, you can, you know, help manage this high volume Manhattan restaurant, and maybe we can do a win-win thing. So that was a no-brainer for me. They were totally committed to having, you know, country and Americana.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was awesome, because I actually got to go into the inside of a high-volume, middle of Manhattan restaurant that's doing a regional cuisine concept. And I got to do a little bit more of that. And now... I'd say, you know, the next 6 to 12 months, I'm going to be doing 2 restaurants, in Manhattan.
It's fantastic.
And maybe something in Austin down the road too.
Really?
Yeah.
Little restaurant. Yeah. But as of now, no more club music.
You know, I get asked almost,
I bet you
every
do
week,
because you're, like, you're beloved. I mean, I wouldn't have you on the show if you weren't, like, a guy that I know that when this goes up, people be like, "Oh, thanks, man, what's going on, Paul?"
So I 100% absolutely want to do something in the live music arena, but I want it to be completely different terms than before. Like, having everything you talked about. When you talk about these communities and these scenes, the ingredients are pretty simple, accessible, easy, a strong culture. You know, everybody is coming from the same place, trying to achieve the same mission, and not a huge focus on the bar or that aspect of the business. This is a music venue. And for me, that's almost a philanthropic project.
Yeah.
And there are there are different ways. There are creative ways. There's, and by the way, there's a lot of thriving music venues in Austin right now. Yeah. So it's not that business as a whole. That's just not interesting. Just doing a bar that has music. There's something better, and it's starting to kind of form. But I think it needs to. This project is going to gestate for a few years, just like the restaurant thing did. But it's coming. I mean, there's something. But selfishly, because it's fun. To participate in that is fun, and to do it on it has to be exciting and totally different from anything that's around right now.
Yeah,
and that's if I partake in music in Austin, Texas, it's going to be, I think, something that's unusual.
Have you been to the place that is in Momo's space?
Yes. Now? Yeah, I went.
Do they really have a pool upstairs?
Yeah, so it is it's a trip. You should go just because
there's a place I want to go to, a place that you can go in your bathing suit and like hang out in a
pool. I don't think it's like a functional pool. Oh. I think it's kind of a, I mean, it's not going to be your scene. No. But it's going to be a trip when you walk in and see, I mean, the place feels huge.
Yeah.
And you don't even get to. I didn't even go upstairs where the pool is. The pool's on. They added another story.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. So it's the pool's on the third.
Jesus.
Yeah. It's a trip. I mean, we were at we just went in because we were at what's that honky tonk that's right there?
Rattle In.
Yeah. Went
it's a great
and saw.
Place.
Oh man, you know who I saw there was. Do you know the very first band to play Momo's? It was a Sunday night when I took it over, and we had a long fucking residency with the South Austin Jug Band that played under different kind of culminations. And then there was these, they'd call themselves Southern Fried back then, but it was, do you know Joe Beckham and John Beckham? And, you should know those guys. They're these McCallum High School boys.
Yeah.
That had an awesome, like, country. It's not country. They good sound, good players.
Yeah.
Good kid, like quintessential Austin look,
you know? Yeah.
And they played that residency went, cause it became the South Austin Jug Band slot became Warren Hood, who was in the band.
Right.
That became his slot, but that was the residency kind of that spanned the whole era of Momo's.
Right.
Those Sunday nights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever catch them?
Yeah.
Because like, that wasn't really your scene. That whole, like, bluegrass kind of... yeah.
There's something about bluegrass that to me, there's like a...
They're not bluegrass.
I think sometimes, like, I'm super into dynamics in music. And so, like, when I come across a style of music that isn't really about the... Because bluegrass starts off at a tempo and with everyone playing at once, and it just kind of goes like a train.
Yeah.
And sometimes that stuff doesn't like reach in and grab me. Yeah. Like something that gets quiet and loud and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, no, not at all. Jack and I... And by the way, Jack Martin is that's a guy who had... You know, because he came to New York.
Yeah.
And he helped me with Zirzamine. And now he's at the McKittrick Hotel.
Oh, yeah?
Running their music program, which is like this off-Broadway Sleep No More production that has like three music venues inside. It's perfect for Jack. But we talk about this kind of stuff all the time. And he's kind of like my, as a non-musician and like, but I've heard so much music.
Right.
That's like my confidant. I can go to him and honestly ask like, man, I really did not like this band. And here's why I think I didn't like it.
Right. Right.
And he would kind of talk me through it. Like, well, these are the things that are annoying you. And this is like, you know, after 6 years of him being my guy, like really helped kind of like extract my taste in music a little bit and dissect a little bit. But God, man, that like, he used to, there would be some, I'm not going to say the genre of music. I won't get into that because I'm not trying to ridicule anybody, but I could see the pain on his face.
Yeah.
Without having to like talk to him at all and just know, you know, like, the I think that's part of the responsibility of being a venue owner is it's you have to make the judge of what's good and bad shit. And there's sometimes really good people that
doing really bad shit.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, it's just like let's even be more passive aggressive about it and say it's just not my thing. It's not my, you know.
Yeah.
But the good of Austin is you can, if you spend a lot of time, you can have a lot of great music. But there's also a lot of bad out there too.
Sure.
But you know what?
And anywhere. I mean, it's like South by Southwest. Like people are like, oh man, there's bands playing everywhere. Yeah. But you know what? 93% of those bands are fucking terrible.
Yeah. You know what Dave Cotton used to say? He's like, man, sometimes bad bands go good. Give them a shot. So
have you been to his place?
I have not been to his place yet.
Yeah.
About time he opened up a place, right?
Yeah.
That so he was my I probably booked the club for at least 50% of its tenure.
Right.
And then he did maybe less than half, but he was a big part of, you know, people in Austin either love or hate him, but you can't deny that he's a
force.
He's a force.
Yeah.
He's a figure and he's seen so much. He's kind of like you ever talk to him?
Yeah,
for a long time.
Are you kidding me?
Like he's a history book of interesting.
Let me tell you, and I think he'll say this too. I got him on here.
Did you really?
Terrible.
Oh, he didn't talk about any. Yeah, okay. Did he get scared?
Yeah, it was live. He wanted to do it live, and I just don't think somebody like that is used to being on stage at all. And so the second he was up there, and it was like, so it was just kind of like. I mean, I'd never seen that look on his face.
Oh my God! But
in all the years that I've known
him, he has some green room stories.
Amazing stories, yeah. And all the great Hicks stories, the Bill Hicks stories.
Yeah.
And stuff. But yeah, the Roost is a good place. They got the old Steamboat sign up there, hanging up there.
Oh, awesome!
Keeping the dream. A lot of it's funny because it really does cast a shadow that club for some reason. It's weird because even like a club like the Continental Club that has. That has had such longevity and kept such just a nice, steady, good pace, healthy pace. Most people don't know Steve. You know what I mean? Or don't.
That's huge.
And, I mean, there's something about the kind of that sort of understated thing about that club that has always been very appealing to me.
Me too.
And I've always enjoyed its success, and that is a place. Like, I mean, there's a ton of great places, and you can always tell places of people, oh, you know, like, but if someone comes to town from somewhere, and they're staying downtown, like a cab or something.
Yeah, you send them to the Continental.
That's the place. Yeah. Like, do you know who's playing there that night? Like, I don't know, it's going to be good.
Doesn't matter. Go.
And if you're going to run into Robert Plant somewhere,
yeah.
or you're going to run into one of the Wilson brothers, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or Richard Linklater. Like, your chances of running into them somewhere in this town are high there. There's a reason why everyone's going there. It's cool. Even if you have no idea who it is, like you walk in there and see James McMurtry for nothing upstairs at the gallery. Like you get to see like this, you know, Dan, you know, go up there and see Dan, Tamika, like all these amazing people.
That was a fun guy to work with.
Yeah.
I have to say that my short tenure as a manager was so revealing. So like, even as a club owner, the Heathens' first tour that I went with them on, like through New Mexico and Colorado and Utah and coming back, I had no idea how shitty venues could be, and I don't just mean in their production, but in the
whole thing,
how they treated the musicians and just like the whole, like it was just really revealing. That's a grind. You go through that, and you have more of those gigs than the good gigs.
Yeah.
That wears you down.
Yeah.
And then also you run into the magic spots, like people who just curate and like they're doing, you don't know how, there's some people, I don't know how they do it. Like the Blue Door in Oklahoma.
Unbelievable. I love that place.
I mean, can you imagine doing something like that in Austin? I mean, you could, but that's not a business. That is art, strictly art.
Totally. That guy has some great shows there.
Yeah.
Is there anything that I'm missing that I've left out, my friend?
Man, no.
I bet people will be glad to hear from you. Because you went away. Some people wondered where you went.
You know, I'll say this. I feel partly guilty, but also the like, you know, I feel like I made the decision. Susan and I made the decision to move to New York, and then actually moved so quick. It went from like a random idea to we're moving next week.
Oh yeah,
that happened so fast. And by the way, like Momo's was still open when I moved to New York.
Yeah,
like it was still running.
Yeah.
But I do. I absolutely feel like I go to a bar and people. It'll beat me up, but I'm like, man, where have you been? Pick up a phone. You know, give me the.
Well, I mean, yeah. I like how you just imitated Joe Hummel for
yeah.
that. So Joe Hummel's mad at you.
Yeah, and he was the one who did that. Oh man, I just saw him in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
a Queens guy. That's the.
Yeah,
I don't know Queens. I spent all my time in Brooklyn and Manhattan.
You live in Manhattan now?
Yeah, I'm in Manhattan now.
Look at you.
I know, like, the whole. Brooklyn is now too cool. A lot of Brooklyn. It's almost coming full circle to where Manhattan is, like, the. Back place,
the underground.
Go. Yeah, yeah.
Manhattan is underground. I mean,
rents are not going down, but you know what's interesting is if you have the luxury of kind of floating around in New York for a bit, there are deals. There are like, you know, like.
But you got to know, you can't just be like, go up there for a weekend and try to find a place to live.
No,
you're going to pay $1 million.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, if you have the patience, there's always someone who. Like, hey, you want my apartment for a year at a ridiculously affordable thing? Like, you can't count on those, but they do exist. Mm-hmm. But I'm starting to wonder if Queens is really the new Brooklyn.
I don't know.
I think it might be. I don't know.
I always drive by there, but I never go to there.
You stay in Brooklyn or you stay in Manhattan?
I stayed in Manhattan and in Brooklyn. They put you up at that. At that Holiday Inn down the street from the Hill Country.
Yeah, yeah.
Last time I stayed a night, the night I went to dinner with you guys, I was staying in Bedford Stuy.
Okay.
That was dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
That was so dangerous. It was a 7-Eleven across the street from my hotel. And the first night when I got there, I was like, hey, is there a place where I can go get like a snack or something? And they're like, oh, there's a 7-Eleven across the street. And I was like, okay. And I started walking out and the guy was like, wait. And I was like, what? And he was like, were you going to walk over there by yourself?
No,
like,
shit.
Yeah.
Oh, you,
like,
were in a, you were in a rough part
don't
of Bed-Stuy.
Don't do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have not seen a gunfight. I've heard one, and I did see a knife get pulled, and Susanna got mugged.
Oh no!
She had it's called what do they call it? Apple picked, where we were living in Inwood, which is like the northernmost tip of Manhattan, very Dominican neighborhood, very cool, like right on this park, an awesome part of Manhattan. But she was walking our dog Sailor. In this park, Fort Tryon Park, and this kid just grabbed her iPhone out of her back pocket and ran. And she chased him down.
Apple picking.
It's called apple picking because it was such a thing, you know. They're so like, it's like a quick cash turnaround on those things. And she ran, tried to chase a guy down. Another woman saw it go down and flagged down a cop. And the cop grabbed Susanna and said, we have the technology to, if you have your Find My iPhone app, and they triangulated it from the car and went, and a bunch of kids dispersed and they caught him, and she had to go, you know, she had to go, testify and all that.
Wow.
She didn't get her phone back, but that was the, like,
welcome to New York.
Yeah. You know, I've, except for my first week, I never feel scared, walking around. I don't know if I have naive fearlessness in New York, but I feel like I blend in walking around there. I don't know.
You're pretty strong dude too.
Maybe it's that too, but the like central part, I mean, we lived on the Upper West Side for a bit, and I would walk after midnight with our dog in Central Park. I felt like I had the whole park to myself. There's some it's couple creepy. Of shady things I stumbled into, but like it's mainly man love.
Yeah.
That's going on.
Right. It's like, not like in Death Wish.
Those
movies? You know what I'm talking about?
No, it's a bunch of dudes walking around looking for like
other dudes.
Businessmen that are looking for
love.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, Paul, it's great to have you on the show. I'm very happy to hear that things are going well for you. I'm looking forward to some restaurant food.
Yes.
And next time I go to New York, some authentic restaurant food.
Yeah.
Restaurant food.
Yeah. We have. I can't wait to talk to you about it.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming to the gig the other night, too. I love you and Susanna. You're my friends. And everyone that remembers Paul from the time of Momo's, the time of Steamboat, the time of, what was it called? Six of Cards?
Six of Clubs, yeah. Thank you for the shout-out, too. That was, I always try to catch. I don't think you know how much, Boy in a Box was played at the club. We played the shit.
Thank you.
It was like up there with This Euphoria in terms of like how many repeats that record got. Yeah.
I just filled up my Spotify and realized that David is almost always the guy I have the most music from in my iPod or music collection or now my Spotify.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul.
Love you,
man.
Love you too. And who's gonna make me a big star?
Cause I can play the part so Paulo Vasey, very, very dear friend. He and Susanna Schaffel are my very, very dear friends, and I'm really glad Paul was able to come by. I feel like he really tied up that whole Momo's story, you know, that we started. Or, you know, it goes on through a lot of the podcast. But with that Heathens episode, we brought in that. Now we got Paul in here, and it kind of ties in the whole thing. If you didn't listen to the Heathens episode, the conversation with Ed Jurdy, fantastic episode going back. It's a couple back, and you can listen to it. Okay, I want to thank Paul for coming by, and he and Susanna are dear, dear friends of mine, and his presence is sorely missed in this scene. So is his club, Momo's, sorely missed. It was a great place. It was a home to many people, including myself. So I want to thank him for having it, and I wish him luck on all of his food endeavors. All right, good luck to Paul. I hope he's safe back in New York. I love him. Guys, if you're out there listening to this show, I don't know how you listen to it. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can go on Stitcher and you can add us to your favorites list. New episodes, they come out. You get a little message on your phone. Hey, you know, new episode of How Did I Get Here out today. Every Tuesday, every Friday on Stitcher, on iTunes, and available, of course, at the Podbean website. All right. You can follow me on Instagram and on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy, and you can like our Facebook page, which is How Did I Get Here. I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to thank Paul for coming out to the show the other night and also for coming by and doing the show. Okay? I also want to remind you that tonight, if you're listening to this the day that it comes out, Tuesday, September 9th, is my last show, my last summer residency show at Strange Brew. Tonight, my guests are Kathy Valentine from the Blue Bonnets, formerly of the Go-Go's, Ryan Hawley, and Joe Reyes, of course, Buttercup, and many other endeavors. All right? Come on out and do that, 8 o'clock, Strange Brew. And, Paulo Vasey, thank you for coming by. Thank you for listening. I love you guys. Bye-bye. Oh, let's get down. The biggest fools ever hit the big time, and all I gotta do is act naturally.